The end of 1969 meant more than another 12 months passing. It was the demise of a decade. The 60s were gone, the 70s beginning. Ironically, more than a century earlier, these lines were recorded. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. So wrote Charles Dickens in 1859. Then, as now, the year was paradoxical.
We cannot learn from one another until we stop shouting at one another.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
He seemed like a nice guy, you know, trustworthy and everything. He didn't seem in any way strange. It's just really hard to believe. It's really shocking that they think he's connected with us.
We must continue to conduct ourselves in a way that we will continue to show to this nation and to Detroit that Detroit is the city where we can live together and work together and build together in harmony.
Linwood and Euclid, the end. Linwood's rifle. All units, 10-5 needs help. Linwood and Euclid.
I like Detroit. I like its people. I would have been glad to continue to serve as police commissioner.
On Chappaquiddick Island, off Martha's Vineyard, I attended on Friday evening, July 18th, a cookout.
I haven't been to a movie in 10 years because they're all so filthy. And you know, I just woke up about this junk.
But I'd rather have the press managing the news of this country than Vice President Agnew.
These are the sounds and voices of one year, as WKNR News presents an electronic diary of 1969. What no man had ever done was done in 1969. A 38-year-old civilian from Wapakoneta, Ohio, took a place in history on July 20th. He was Neil Armstrong, and he spoke from more than 241,000 miles away.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Man's centuries-old dream of visiting other worlds came true when Armstrong stepped onto the moon's surface on that Sunday in July. From a Cape Kennedy blast-off, the Apollo 11 flight was perfect. But the world waited anxiously when the landing module approached the Sea of Tranquility. The LEM's automatic guidance system was taking the craft toward a rough landing area. Just 200 feet from touchdown, Armstrong calmly took over and manually flew the craft to a safe landing. The descent engine had only 55 seconds of fuel left when man's first words came from the moon.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
A few hours later, Armstrong left the LEM, stepped onto the moon, and was soon joined by fellow astronaut Edwin Aldrin.
Beautiful view. Isn't that something? Magnificent sight out here. Magnificent desolation.
While Armstrong and Aldrin explored the lunar surface and carried out their collections and experiments, Michael Collins orbited above in the command ship. The Apollo flight had a primary purpose, and it was accomplished. Man could fly to the moon, land, and return safely. The commitment had come 8 years earlier.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
John F. Kennedy speaking in May of 1961. Apollo 11 stirred what had become a lagging public interest in the space program. Detroiters reacted to the incredible event.
I was talking to my father last night, and he said that when he was younger, he never thought he'd see anything like this. And I'm really glad that I can see it.
Well, I think it's one of the most amazing things that's ever happened.
First ones in the moon? I think that's great.
Just great. You never could believe it would happen, but here it is.
In November, we did it again. This time, Apollo 12 and some frightening moments during liftoff.
Okay, we just lost the platform, gang. I don't know what happened here. We had everything in the world drop out. Right now, there are problems here. I don't know what happened. I'm not sure we can get hit by lightning. Okay, we're all chuckling up here over the lights. We all said there were so many on, we couldn't read them. And I'll tell you one thing, it's a first-class ride, Houston.
The spacecraft had indeed been struck by lightning, but the difficulty was momentary. Pete Conrad, Alan Bean, Dick Gordon took it in stride. And a few days later, Conrad and Bean became the third and fourth men to walk the moon's surface after a pinpoint landing. Conrad became the happy astronaut, enjoying it all quite openly.
Boy, you'll never believe it. That's what I see sitting on the side of the crater. The old surveyor, huh?
The old surveyor, yes, sir.
Does that look neat? It can't be any further than 600 feet from here. How about that? Boy, do I sink in. Wow. Dum-dum-dum-dum.
Eight more moon exploration flights are planned. Experiments will become more sophisticated, and flights to other planets are a virtual certainty, with trips to the stars sounding much less outlandish than we once believed.
Do Richard Milhouse Nixon do solemnly swear?
I, Richard Milhouse Nixon, do solemnly swear
that you will faithfully execute the office.
That I will faithfully execute the office
of President of the United States.
Of President of the United States.
The torch was passed in 1969. In less than 1 minute's time, on a January day, Lyndon Johnson became a Texas rancher, Hubert Humphrey a Minnesota professor, and Richard Nixon the 37th President of the United States. He entered calmly, calling for quiet.
We cannot learn from one another until we stop shouting at one another, until we speak quietly enough so that our words can be heard as well as our voices.
In direct contrast to the Johnson years, there were few presidential news conferences, few nationwide speeches. It was a time of assessment, but as the months wore on, disenchantment set in. Inflation mounted, and White House efforts to curb it showed few immediate results. The civil rights program of the Nixon administration was in a state of confusion. Neither liberal nor conservative could analyze what it was or what it wasn't. It was a turbulent year for the nation's highest court. What Abe Fortas had been to Lyndon Johnson, Clement Haynsworth became to Richard Nixon. Justice Fortas resigned under pressure in May. The president had named Warren Burger as Chief Justice, then picked a Carolina jurist to fill the Fortas vacancy. The case against Clement Haynsworth grew with abandon. Questions of stock market manipulating while serving as a federal district judge. Not illegal, but tinged with ethical implications. The Democratic opposition received powerful support, including newly elected GOP whip, Senator Robert Griffin of Michigan, a man whose stature had grown with the successful Fortas fight. There was strain with the top.
Well, there's a little strain temporarily, but this is the way it is. Leaders in Congress are expected occasionally to vote the way they believe is right, even though it differs with the leadership of their own party. And I hope that I'll never give up that right, because I think that's very important.
When the Senate votes were counted, Judge Haynsworth remained in South Carolina, and the vacancy remained on the Supreme Court. Michigan's Democratic Senator Philip Hart was not surprised.
It was an unwise nomination, and for me, I wish the president had withdrawn it. But failing that, I think the action the Senate took was correct, and in the long run will serve well the court.
But all of the home front problems seemed minor when compared with the biggest headache of all, Vietnam. It had been Mr. Johnson's war. In 69, it became Mr. Nixon's war. The Paris talks yielded no visible results. The plans to Vietnamize the war led to the announced withdrawal of 110,000 U.S. troops, this to be accomplished by April of 1970. The anti-war movement at home had continued to mushroom. Those opposing the war had remained quiet at year's beginning, but their patience ended, and a fall offensive was launched. M-Day was October 15th. Around the nation, thousands marched and rallied for peace in their own cities and towns. And 1 month later, on November 15th, came the March on Washington. It was without doubt the biggest ever. Estimates of more than 250,000 people were considered conservative. It was a blustery, bitter cold day in the nation's capital, but no one seemed to care. They had their reasons to be there. Among the Michigan delegation, Jerry Agin, a Warren school teacher.
Why did I come? Well, for a lot of reasons. I've been opposed to the war back in 1963 when it was very unpopular and called a communist by a lot of people. And I have a four-year-old son, for example, and when it used to be popular to, you know, say, did your daddy fight in the Army or Navy? And I'm not the forecaster, but I surely don't want him fighting in an immoral, illegal war in Bolivia or some other Latin American or African country 10, 15 years from now.
If this war continues, will you continue to participate in this sort of thing?
Absolutely.
Or as
Absolutely.
Long as necessary?
As long as necessary.
The president had said in advance he would not be swayed by such demonstrations, and he called for support from the public. That portion of the public that he termed the silent majority. It appeared the support was truly there, but the majority seemed content to remain silent. Late in the year, the nation's conscience was shocked by accusations of atrocities at My Lai.
What appears was certainly a massacre, and under no circumstances was it justified. One of the goals we are fighting for in Vietnam is to keep the people from South Vietnam from having imposed upon them a government which has atrocity against civilians as one of its policies. And we cannot ever condone or use atrocities against civilians in order to accomplish that goal. Now, when you use the word alleged, that is only proper in terms of the individuals involved. Under our system, a man is not guilty until proved to be so.
It had happened, they said, nearly 2 years earlier. Scores of South Vietnamese civilians wantonly slaughtered in a small hamlet by American GIs. There were photographs and some eyewitnesses. One officer was charged, Lieutenant William Calley. Others were under investigation.
August 8th to 048. September 3rd.
We played the numbers game in 1969. For the first time since World War II, a lottery draft system. Simply stated, most young men with the highest and lowest numbers knew their future. The lottery was the first step in a new draft system, and for the time being, the clearest. The first year of the Nixon administration may have been low-key, but there was one loud voice.
A virtual monopoly of the whole medium of communication is not something that democratic people should blithely ignore. And we are not going to cut off our television sets just because the airways belong to the networks. They don't. They belong to the people.
Just a few months in office, and barely known before that, Spiro T. Agnew turned the trick and made the vice presidency a center of both attention and controversy. Mr. Agnew made more than 70 speeches, and in them he added some colorful, if not syntactically correct, phrases to the language of the year. The effete core of impudent snobs, in referring to leaders of the anti-war movement. Ideological eunuchs, in reference to administration opponents. The vice president's attack on the news media put him in the headlines. Many agreed with his assessments, but questioned his credentials. Maine's Edmund Muskie viewed it this way.
The press, of course, whether you speak about the newspapers or the television or radio media, are operated by human beings and subject to criticism just as are the rest of us. But I must say that I'd rather have the press managing the news of this country than Vice President Agnew.
On Chappaquiddick Island, off Martha's Vineyard, I attended on Friday evening, July 18th, a cookout I had encouraged...
1969 was the year of the rise and fall of Edward Kennedy, senator from Massachusetts, and the remaining brother of a politically powerful family. With the 91st Congress going into session, Senator Kennedy had been elected Majority Whip. He had the flair, the fortune, and it seemed to most Democrats, the presidency when he wanted it. But events in July may have changed all of that.
For this reason, and because she was such a gentle, kind, an idealistic person, all of us tried to help her feel that she still had a home with the Kennedy family.
A car driven by the senator had plunged off a narrow bridge into a tidal pool on Chappaquiddick Island. A passenger, Mary Jo Kopechne, drowned. Senator Kennedy escaped. But there was a 10-hour gap between the accident and the report of it. Later, he addressed the people of his home state, offering a vague explanation of confusion and shock. An inquest is scheduled, but the questions remain, and the towers of Camelot were tottering. Detroit was destined for political change in 1969.
After living 8 years with the very heavy burdens of this office, I've decided that the time has come to give greater consideration to the needs of my children. Therefore, I shall not be a candidate for re-election as mayor.
Jerome Patrick Kavanaugh, two-term mayor of the nation's fifth largest city, was stepping down. 8 years, he said, was enough. To be sure, Mr. Kavanaugh's political life was not ending, but the infighting and the gaps between goals and fruition had taken their toll. His decision not to seek re-election opened the floodgates.
I've decided to become a candidate for the office of mayor of the city of Detroit.
The people are anxious and willing to consider a black.
I'm going to run as a law and order and justice candidate.
Then is it not time for us to determine that we have to follow a course of action that will hopefully...
I waited until the last possible moment for someone to come forward as a candidate who displayed a realistic ability to provide the leadership required.
The primary narrowed down to two candidates, both Wayne County officials, Sheriff Roman Gribbs, 43 and white, Auditor Richard Austin, 56 and black. The platforms were vague, the campaign less than impassioned. Witness this reaction to a question from newsman Jim Brooker.
Neither of you think that this campaign has any life in it?
That's for you to decide.
The man laughing had reason to. He won.
We've conducted a campaign that has earned Detroit the respect and admiration of the entire nation. In the campaign's aftermath, we must continue to conduct ourselves in a way that we will continue to show to this nation and to Detroit that Detroit is the city where we can live together and work together and build together in harmony.
The margin was narrow, a 6,000-vote separation, and a moral victory for the city's first major black mayoral candidate. As Richard Austin viewed it...
I don't believe at this moment, at least I'm not going to accept the conclusion that the people base their decision on emotion. We've simply accepted the verdict, and why don't we leave it at that?
The election also gave the city a new council, or at least nearly new, and mostly liberal. There was another political change. George Romney made it to Washington as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and Michigan had a new governor.
Cities are the center of life in our society, in our state, but there likewise is no question that cities are in deep trouble. And to the extent that state government can relate to those problems and to assist in the solution of those problems, we intend to do that.
William Milliken, youthful-looking former Traverse City state legislator, who served as lieutenant governor and had been groomed to move to the top. He inherited a profusion of problems. Supervisors' salaries became a soap opera of sorts in 69. It started with statewide redistricting, ostensibly designed to change large, unwieldy county boards into more workmanlike units of government. However, no salary provisions were made, and it was up to the supervisors to set their own income. In Wayne County, politicians had hopped on the bandwagon to run for 24 seats. The new board took office in January, and the battle began. Led by Albert Zack, former Hamtramck mayor, members quietly voted themselves a $24,000 annual income for a job with no defined duties. The story broke, there was public outcry, Chairman Zack blamed the media.
The news media have distorted the question on compensation in our activities, and I've taken out of context my statements in the past, which further distorted the question.
Finally, after long debate, some closed-door meetings, continuing public pressure, and varied salary figures, they agreed on a $10,000 figure plus $2,000 more for the chairman. To some, it was outlandish, said Supervisor Paul Silver.
This was the greatest boondoggle, and I don't remember who said it, but this fell just below the two Brinks robberies in Boston, the Great Train robbery, and as one constituent said, Jesse James used a gun, we try to do it without a gun.
And as for Chairman Zack, always the public servant, he allowed money really meant little.
I'll work for $3 a day if necessary. I'll be a dedicated public official.
Linwood and Euclid, Tarzan 10, Linwood and Euclid, 10-5, there have men with rifles.
Saturday, March 29th. Two Detroit policemen investigate men with rifles leaving a church. What you're hearing is the actual police recording. Listen carefully as a wounded officer calls for help and cries in pain.
All units, 10-5 needs help. Linwood and Euclid. Officer in trouble, Linwood and Euclid. Our units, officer in trouble, Linwood and Euclid. They're shooting. Linwood and Euclid. Officer needs help. They're shooting at him.
The patrolman Richard Warabek, seriously wounded, but able to crouch on the floor of his squad car, operating the gas pedal by hand to get out of the line of fire. In front of the New Bethel Baptist Church, his partner, 22-year-old Michael Chopsky, lay dead. Help arrived fast. Other officers stormed the church building, spraying bullets ahead of them. Cowering inside, 147 men, women, and children. Fortunately, the fusillade wounded only four. There were mass arrests. The church had been the scene of a Republic of New Africa meeting, a separatist group maintaining an armed guard unit known as the Black Legion. Among those arrested, members of that militant guard. The event itself was tragic enough, but it was compounded in the early hours Sunday when Negro Judge George Crockett ordered the release of most of those arrested on constitutional grounds. Negro leaders denounced police for the church shoot-up. Council member Reverend Nicholas Hood keynoted it.
We deplore what went on outside of the church. We're only concerned here with what went on inside of the church. There is no condoning of this kind of activity on the part of any of us, but we're concerned that the house of God has just been indiscriminately shot up by somebody.
Officers maintained they shot into the church because they were fired upon. Later, Judge Crockett's courtroom was picketed as he steadfastly defended his actions.
If the killing had occurred in a white neighborhood, I believe the sequence of events would have been far different. Because a terrible crime was committed, it does not follow that other wrongs be permitted or condoned. Indeed, constitutional safeguards are needed even more urgently in times of tension than in ordinary times.
And Michael Chopsky was buried. The funeral, the largest in the history of the police department, as an already polarized community separated further. Some weeks later, charges were filed against a New Yorker, Rafael Vieira. He at first fought extradition, but finally returned to Detroit to maintain his innocence.
I was inside the church when the shooting started. I was outside first, and then I went inside the church, and all of a sudden I heard one loud bang, you know, and then all of a sudden I heard several other bangs. But then after a while I saw glass breaking, and I said, hold. So I started taking care of the women and children, pushing them down on the floor. Before I knew it, they were shooting in the windows.
Did you have a weapon that night, a gun?
No, I didn't.
Were you then surprised when you were named?
When I found out about the war, and I said, what's this?
You had no idea.
No, it took me back completely.
How did you first find out about the war?
I heard it over the radio, I believe.
Vieira's trial is yet to come, and despite the magnitude of the new Bethel Church incident, the black and white of Detroit had learned a costly lesson 2 years earlier. The efforts to live together increased, and no one worked harder to improve police-community relations than the top cop, Johannes Spreen. A man with a lifetime of police experience, he had taken over in 68, a task many had turned down. He was the great innovator. They called him Scooter Spreen when he introduced scooter patrols to build rapport with the citizenry. He called for a 100-day love-in, a cooling-off period to stop criticism of police and permit them to do their main job, fight crime. The public loved it. He was the poet policeman. Youngsters sent him valentines.
I think this is a very good thing, a gratifying thing to receive. On this big valentine, it says, "Our cops are tops." It says, "With love to the fuzz, have a successful love-in."
And Spreen wanted citizen participation.
I'm announcing the answer, perhaps, to this year's most frequently asked question. What can I, as a citizen, do to help my police department? The answer is, buck up, your police department.
His appeal for dollars worked. More than 50,000 of them came in. But the commissioner had his political problems. There was an unsympathetic council that refused requests for more money and more police. He threatened to quit. And one youngster, 16-year-old Michael Benson, stated the concern many felt.
You're not really quitting, are you?
No, not as long as we can keep winning the battle, or at least moving ahead a little bit. When, you know, if I move up 3 feet and drop back five, this is a problem. But if we move up 3 feet and drop back only two, well, we're gaining.
But the reign of Johannes Spreen was to end with that of outgoing Mayor Kavanaugh. The new mayor wanted his own man, and the commissioner, with charisma, bowed out philosophically.
When I accepted this position, my friends in New York said, "Not Detroit." And I've met the people here. This is a fine city with fine people. All it needs is a chance and a little luck. And as I leave my office, I say, "Why not Detroit?"
Late in December, the mayor-elect picked his successor, Patrick Murphy, another veteran policeman and, oddly enough, once Spreen's boss. A quieter man, but again an innovator.
Like all of the nation's cities, Detroit suffers from a serious crime problem. But hard work and dedication can generate and strengthen the citizen understanding, respect, and cooperation which is necessary for the police to be more effective in controlling crime.
The incoming Murphy faces many difficulties, but perhaps the path has been paved.
Starting off with the first case, of course, we had a missing from Eastern Michigan. The second girl was from Eastern Michigan. The method of operation was...
This is Ann Arbor really Police Chief Walter Krasny. He's talking about murder. In this case, seven murders, all young women, all brutally killed, many molested, most from the campuses of the University of Michigan or nearby Eastern Michigan. Two of the killings dated back to 1967 and 68, but there were five between March 20th and July 26th of 1969. They were called the co-ed killings. A madman was on the loose, and fear gripped the Washtenaw County area. The police probe was confused. The victims had been found within the city and in outlying areas. Different agencies were handling the murders. At one point, Dutch psychic and entertainer Peter Herkos was brought in. He had been involved in the Boston Strangler case. Police did not invite him, but they did cooperate. And Herkos relished his moment in the limelight.
Very sick man. I have no respect for him.
Would be a young man or an old man.
I'm after him. He's after me, I'm after him.
The Herkos visit proved nothing. Finally, the governor ordered state officials into the case, mainly to coordinate activities. Attorney General Kelly detailed the concern.
Your state government is taking every available step to help the professional law enforcement officers on the scene solve these horrible crimes and bring those responsible to justice.
One day later, an arrest was made. 23-year-old John Norman Collins, an Eastern Michigan senior, was charged with the killing of Karen Sue Bineman, the last victim. Ironically, police were led to Collins when his uncle, a state police corporal, noticed some oddities at his home. Collins had cared for a family dog during a vacation. Collins was a cycle enthusiast, was described as an all-American type, quiet, athletic, a good student. His friends were shocked.
He seemed like a nice guy, you know, trustworthy and everything. He didn't seem in any way strange, you know, or suspecting. It's just really hard to believe. It's really shocking that they think he's connected with this.
Collins goes on trial in 1970. He's charged with only the one murder, but there have been no unsolved co-ed killings since his arrest. Ann Arbor had other troubles during the year. It was June, and the so-called street people wanted a portion of Ann Arbor's South University Street closed to traffic and made into a mall. The powers that be said no, so the street people took over the street. Police had other ideas. There were several tense nights, some rock and bottle throwing, many injuries and arrests. But as it is with such incidents, it ended, and little more was heard. In the fall, again in Ann Arbor, it was a question of a bookstore. U of M students wanted a university-operated store with some student control. Book prices had become a problem, they said. The protesters took over a campus building, and University President Robin Fleming offered an opinion.
They're interested in great changes in society across the board, and this is simply a handy vehicle because they know there is considerable student interest in the subject of a bookstore.
In the end, using less militant tactics, the students won their fight. A university bookstore was to be. At other Michigan campuses, there were also problems. At Ferris State, troubled times when a black-white battle broke out. At Michigan State, Negro students took over a cafeteria. The incidents were short-lived. Nationwide, the issues varied. The tactics didn't. But the problems of education in Michigan mounted. Not only a matter of money, also of what to teach and how to teach it. The new governor laid out a massive and costly education reform program. Mr. Milliken emphasized it was time for action.
We can't have total reform with timid proposals. We can no longer continue the waste of human and financial resources which are now occurring in our outmoded educational system.
Included in the governor's billion-dollar package, aid to private and parochial schools, parochiaid. It had been and continued to be the center of controversy. The governor proposed including $25 million of state aid for private schools. The action brought long debate and intensive lobbying on both sides. And then there was the testy issue of sex education. Should it be taught, and if so, how? No single problem raised more furor. The State Board of Education scheduled a series of public hearings on the issue. And those that opposed did so without reservation.
I haven't been to a movie in 10 years because they're all so filthy. And you know, I just woke up about this junk. And when I read Rosemary's Baby, I saw the connection here. Do you know our school board is teaching the religion of the devil and immorality?
One victim of the sex education battle, State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Dr. Ira Polly. He had okayed certain materials for use in those schools offering such courses, but without Board of Education approval. He came under fire and finally resigned. In the world of business, a longtime auto executive got the axe. Seaman Knudsen was dismissed as president of the Ford Motor Company. He had left General Motors a year before in what was considered a coup for Ford. That romance ended in September.
As an experienced businessman, I'm puzzled by this sudden and unexpected action. Until September 2nd, I was looking forward to a long-term happy relationship with a company where I enjoyed both my associates and my work.
Said Henry Ford II, it just didn't work out.
He certainly has had tremendous experience in the automobile business, and I felt that we could use the kinds of experience that he'd had. When I say it didn't work out, isn't that clear? It just didn't work.
Miss Michigan had some luck. She became Miss America. Pam Eldred had been on the beauty circuit before, but the top prize led Women's Wear Daily to question her mental involvement. In fact, they termed the new Miss America a goody-two-shoes. The Queen didn't care.
I know that they didn't like me or didn't care for me, and I felt bad that, you know, when people don't like you, but everybody has their own opinion. And I just hope throughout the year that I can change this opinion that they have of me.
One of the year's unusual confrontations came in all-white Dearborn, where longtime mayor Orville Hubbard, a man whose conservative views left few questions, met Reverend Ralph Abernathy of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. It appeared Mayor Hubbard was softening.
Oh, how are you, sir?
I'm Mayor Hubbard. Thank you.
Delighted to meet you,
Thank you, Mr.
Mayor. Pleasure to come to your city.
Fellows just asked me today, he said, would you like to have Mr. Abernathy live here? I said, we sure would.
Well, it may be that when I finish solving the problems of the South and of the nation and put an end to poverty, I'll retire here and do it.
Thank you. I think you're doing a good job.
Some voices were stilled in 69. Among them, Irene Castle and Nicky Hilton, Thelma Ritter and Charles Winninger, Ralph McGill and Drew Pearson, Everett McKinley Dirksen and Dwight David Eisenhower, Dr. Philip Blyberg and Philip Barnum, Judy Garland and Sonia Haney, Walter Hagen, Rocky Marciano, Tony Pastor and Russ Morgan, Robert Taylor and Boris Karloff, Frank Lesser and Frank Clement, Reverend James Pike and Levy Eshcole, and Ho Chi Minh, Joseph P. Kennedy and Judge Thomas J. Murphy, John L. Lewis, John Shada, and Leroy Augenstein. As in all years, there were other deaths. A storm named Camille killed 300. A nine-day rain in California led to 91 deaths, and tornadoes took their toll. 24 Americans died when the carrier Melbourne collided with the destroyer Evans. And Americans persisted in continuing that mass slaughter on the highways. But the bright moments were many. Picture a conservative vice president with a 13-year-old daughter who wants to participate in a moratorium day. Mrs. Agnew remembered it.
Wanted to wear a black armband because some of her schoolmates were going to wear black armbands. And finally she had a discussion with her father and myself as to what the moratorium was all about. And she even asked what the history in Vietnam was. She was a little unhappy because she couldn't wear the black armband but like the rest of her classmates were going to do. But she abided by our wishes. And another day's time, she was playing her Beatle records backwards to find out whether Paul McCartney had left the message or not.
What Kim Agnew listened for, a clue to the McCartney mystery. Was he dead or alive? To some, the Beatles played backwards didn't really sound much different than the Beatles played forward. To others, there was a message in it. They searched symbolic album covers, listened to recordings in reverse and at various speeds. But it all ended happily. Paul, his wife, and child were in Scotland, alive and well and rich. Record sales were never better. Other events and names of 1969 were myriad. What was called a happening happened in mid-August. It was Woodstock, billed as a music and art fair. An all-star cast of the top rock artists lured more than 400,000 youngsters to a New York farm. Youth got together, and America took notice. An archbishop was elevated. He became John Cardinal Dearden. There was a new hijacking record, 6,900 miles, a circuitous route from Fresno to Rome. In France, de Gaulle lost and left. Two accused assassins were convicted. Saran Saran faces the gas chamber in California. James Earl Ray, 99 years in Tennessee. For Clay Shaw, an acquittal in New Orleans. In Michigan, a self-proclaimed mafia songbird sang some funny tunes. Some listened, most didn't. Drugs caused more concern than ever. There were problems for Black Panthers. In New Jersey, a crackdown on crime and some officials were officially charged. In Hollywood, Sharon Tate and others met murder, and the arrests brought out a bizarre tale of a modern-day Svengali. In Northern Ireland, a religious war raged, and Arabs and Israelis continued to fight. Dr. Spock and friends won in court, while a colonel named Riolt never made it. General Hershey moved aside, by request, and in Washington, Lady Bird, Linda Bird, and Lucy were replaced by Pat and Tricia and Julie. There were cyclamates, and then there were not. There was a black manifesto and money demands. There was a merger for Hudson's and Dayton's. A deserter named Sinkovich in a church sanctuary. John Sinclair with a long prison term for marijuana. At Michigan State, a new president named Wharton. At Michigan, a new coach named Bow, and a victory over the unbeaten for all the Roses. There was no repeat for the Tigers. It was the year of the Jets and the Mets, of Namath and Seaver, of Andretti and Granatelli and Orville Moody. There was a Michigan Golf Classic with no purse, a sophomore named Haywood who turned pro. There was the resurgence of the Lions and some bitter goodbyes from Gadsby and Sane. And there was a wedding when Miss Vicky became Mrs. Tim. And so it was, not just another year, rather another decade. A decade of dissent and discovery. A chaotic period of protest and revolt. We sent men to the moon and back, but couldn't learn to live with each other. A 10-year excursion has ended and passed to its place among the things that were. What we remember and what we forget may determine what lies ahead. For WKNR News, I'm Philip Nye. The end of 1969 meant more than another 12 months passing. It was the demise of a decade. The 60s were gone, the 70s beginning. Ironically, more than a century earlier, these lines were recorded.